since she was 10 and now finds herself imprisoned in a military interrogation center. KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. And now stay tuned for Health Watch. Health Watch talks to authors of What's Making Our Children Sick? How Industrial Food is Causing an Epidemic of Chronic Illness and What Parents Can Do About It.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Trivia Fundraiser for Northeast Neighborhood Emergency Teams on Thursday, January 11th at 6 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room in Portland. This fundraiser includes disaster theme and pop culture trivia led by Katie Wolf, food, beer, cider, and information about your local neighborhood emergency teams. Again, that's the Trivia Fundraiser for Northeast Neighborhood Emergency Teams on Thursday, January 11th at 6 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room, 237 Northeast Broadway Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Ellen Goldsmith, licensed acupuncturist, your host. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Michelle Perro, medical doctor, and Dr. Vincent Adams, medical anthropologist, co-authors of the recently published book, What's Making Our Children Sick? How Industrial Food is Causing an Epidemic of Chronic Illness and What Parents and Doctors Can Do About It. This book explores the links between industrialized, GMO, and pesticide-laden foods and the rising numbers of chronic and complex disorders among American children. There are hundreds of thousands of parents desperately looking to their children's declining health. However, there is hope, and it starts with food. Michelle Perro, medical doctor, is a veteran pediatrician with over 35 years of experience in acute and integrative medicine. She has both directed and worked as attending physician from New York's Metropolitan Hospital to the University of California at San Francisco Benioff Children's Hospital in Oakland. She is currently lecturing and consulting and working with Gordon Medical Associates, an integrative health center in Northern California. Vincent Adams, PhD, is a professor and vice chair of medical anthropology at the University of California, San Francisco. She has previously published 6 books on the social dynamics of health, scientific knowledge, and politics, and is currently the editor for Medical Anthropology Quarterly. Michelle Perro and Vincent Adams, welcome to Health Watch.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Michelle here, and thank you, Ellen.
Wonderful. In the beginning of your book, you start out by saying that our children are sick because they're exposed to toxicants in the water, air, food, furniture, and petrochemical products being used. How is this exposure affecting children's health, making them, as you say, sick from the inside out?
This is something that we as integrative clinicians have been looking at because in our practices we've seen a decline in children's health. I've seen it personally, particularly over the past 15 to 20 years. What's happening is that children have developed an alarming rate of chronic disorders. Everything from asthma and food allergies, which is off the chart, to neurocognitive disorders, which includes issues like autism and ADHD. Many of these chronic, complex, hard-to-diagnose disorders leave traditional, conventional physicians scratching their heads, not knowing what to do next with these kids. When we look at them clinically, as well as looking at lab tests and other tools in the integrative clinician's toolbox, there are striking abnormalities. When we make corrections, beginning with food in their diet, they get better, Ellen.
So, you know, the adage after 2000 was, you know, let's cut out the sugar, let's cut out the junk food and the processed food. But you're really talking about something that's deeper, that's kind of endemic throughout the food supply. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, what we're talking about is more than that. The food supply has changed since 1996 with the introduction of genetically modified food, also known as herbicide-tolerant foods, such as corn, soy, canola, alfalfa, which is fed to our livestock, which we then eat as meat. These are the key components of children's diets. And because these herbicide-tolerant crops don't die when you spray chemical herbicides on them, such as glyphosate, and we go into that in depth in the book. There's been increased spraying of these crops that our children eat because of weed resistance to the herbicide. So our children are getting a dual whammy. They're not only eating these genetically modified foodstuffs, which have issues, as well as increasing amounts of herbicides and other chemicals. In addition to other toxins and toxicants that also enter, it's causing significant issues, which we can go into in their tummies, Ellen.
Right. It all starts with the tummy. So let's talk about that. What's going on? How is this affecting the gut and the digestive system?
Okay, I'll continue. So what we've seen now, and this is something not well reported in conventional medicine, is something called leaky gut or intestinal permeability. So it appears that probably what we've looked at from rat studies and pig studies and cow studies, remember, there are no human studies looking at genetically modified food and their associated pesticides, that it causes inflammation of the tummies as well as this leaky gut. And what happens is there are little holes that get punctured in. And a better way to describe it is that the little gates which monitor what goes in and out of their guts has become faulty. So they have a lot of stuff passing through their intestines which shouldn't be, which are causing such things as chronic inflammation. In addition, what we suspect is happening based on animal studies is that their microbiome, the bacteria in their guts, have become dysbiotic, or another way of saying that is imbalanced. And we now know, literature is pouring out daily, Ellen, that this microbiome is important for immune function, production of vitamins, hormones, detoxification, and neurotransmitters, among other things. So what we have is a double whammy. We have kids whose guts are leaky, and they have these imbalanced microbiome or bacteria in their guts.
So, you know, for a parent out there listening, and they're going, well, you know, my kid doesn't have any digestive problems. They just have, you know, asthma, or they just have, like, some skin issues. So maybe you could talk a little bit for our listeners to understand the relationship between a leaky gut, inflammation, and problems, health issues that, quote, may not seem related to digestion.
So where we have to start and what we tell parents is that the gut is responsible for 70% of immune function. So when the gut is inflamed, not working, unhappy, for whatever the reasons that we're starting to, you know, go into here, that can cause further imbalances. For example, let's just look at asthma and their immune function. And it's called their T helper 1 and 2 cells, and these become out of balance. These immune dysfunctions just don't stay in the gut. They travel out and go to other parts of the body. Remember, the body's not a series of organs like a lung and a kidney and a brain. It's a complex biological system. And when one thing is not working properly, the whole system can become corrupted, so to speak. So you have these, for example, immune imbalances, and those can affect distant areas such as the lung, and they can develop hyperactive airway or asthma. In addition, if the microbiome is disturbed, let's say because glyphosate is an antibiotic, for example, that dysbiotic gut and we now know that a preponderance of certain kind of microbes can affect organs as far away as the skin, one of the biggest organs in our body with a big absorptive capacity, and can cause a chronic condition such as eczema, affecting a significant amount of children, which is not a life-threatening disorder, but incredibly uncomfortable and not pleasant for children to deal with. So we have to understand that this leaky gut can cause problems elsewhere, asthma, eczema, and another concerning finding is leaky brain. Yes, ma'am, those same little issues can go right up into kids' heads and cause disorders from everything from anxiety, depression, to focus issues. And it's complex, and I'm trying to simplify it for your show and your listeners, Ellen, but it's fixable. These disorders are fixable, and they're interconnected.
So where do people start to fix it?
Well, you know, it starts with food. Boy, if the listeners could read our book, they would definitely come home with the take-home message that our food supply, what we call in the book industrial food or modern food, is not the same thing grandma was eating, you know, 30 years ago. And if they can possibly switch to organic food, is what we recommend. They would not be eating various pesticides or GMOs, and that's one good place to start. And I know a lot of parents say, well, gee, it's really expensive to buy organic food. So if they can switch to a more plant-based diet and use less meat, that can be helpful. And there are many ways that you can eat organic affordably. It's challenging, and someone's got to get back in the kitchen, Ellen. And hopefully it's not just mom. But that's where we have to start. I also recommend filtered water as well.
So, Vincent, from your perspective as a medical anthropologist, what have you been noting with all of this?
Well, I have to confess that when I first met Michelle and heard her start to talk about GM foods and chronic ill health, I was a pretty big skeptic. I think like a lot of people who go to the internet and start reading about these things, I was convinced that it was a conspiracy theory. And I mean, in all honesty, it was a bit of a sort of awakening for me when I realized that Michelle had a great story. And my entry point for working with her was, I was really fascinated by the fact that she was dealing with the patients that weren't getting help from their regular doctors. You know, the chronically sick kids who hadn't been given anything except analgesics and Band-Aids for their kids' chronic problems, but no real explanation of what was going on, and certainly no cures. And so I jumped in and thought, well, this is a really interesting story that she's actually getting some beneficial results from the methods that she's using. And then that led me into looking more at the science and the literature, which, as you probably know, is a huge rat's nest of information. I mean, it's very hard to decipher where the truth is on these things. In the end, and after interviewing lots of the scientists and attending a lot of the retreats and wading through the science and getting consultation from the scientists on both sides, I decided that I really couldn't resist, and I'd have to sort of help her write this book by bringing my knowledge base to the project, which is really about what I contributed was the sort of context, you know, why this is more than just a health problem and a clinical problem. This is a social problem on a grand scale. We've got this cataclysm of at least three things. You know, one is the reluctance on the part of medical communities in the face of this massive epidemic of chronic diseases and the inability to deal with chronicity, but also the inability to really address food as a source of pathogenesis and cure. And then we've got a food regulatory system that's just full of holes, and GM foods have unfortunately slipped through a lot of those cracks. And then we have this history of science on genetic modification and pesticides that's really made it very difficult to get at the truth, and in fact, in many instances, has, in my opinion, obscured the facts about it. So that's what I brought to the project.
Well, I mean, there's a context here, right? Because there's the social, political aspect to it, the economics that supersede the health on an individual level, but also you talk a lot in the book about, you know, the health of the soil, the health of the planet, the health of the ecosystem. You know, all of these things are having a huge impact on our health, and especially developing children's health, which is much more vulnerable, right?
Yeah, kids are much more vulnerable. I've heard Michelle talk about kids as being the canaries in the coal mine. It's often an overused metaphor, but it's true on some level. We talk about in the book something that we're calling eco-medicine, and there are other people that use that term, but we really think that, you know, medicine, and, you know, if there was a constituency that we could get to with this book, in my mind, the most important one would be the medical community. To get them to really start getting the paradigms that are used in medicine to really pay attention to the relationships between the soil and the health of the microbes in the soil, which get then passed to food, which then get passed into the body, and the health of the microbiome, which is a kind of soil of the body, if you will.
Right. So what kinds of changes, Dr. Perro, are you seeing in children when you start to change the health of their gut?
Many things happen, and they happen on an individual basis, because as you know, Ellen, and I believe you are a health practitioner, it's a very individualized response to treatment. And so, but within a very short time, what the first thing that you notice is their tummies get better. And the kind of tummy issues that I'm describing and seeing on a profound basis are things like bloating, gas, constipation, and reflux. those almost immediately get better as we begin to change their diets. Now, we have to appreciate here, and not to be naive, that when I have a patient, I'm doing a lot more than just changing their diet. But what I have noticed is that the family members get significantly better, and they're not my patients necessarily, although some of them become patients later. They get better too, and what they often do is just change their diets to organic. And so you start to see a healing of the gut. As the gut heals, the kids often have more energy, so many of them are fatigued at a young age. Kids are normally bouncing around, not all of them. Their moods stabilize. A lot of cranky kids out there, focus may improve. Arthralgias, which are joint aches, can get better. And overall, just sense of wellness improves. What we're trying to do is kickstart the ability of the body's innate healing aspects to kind of, I think, re-kick up, Ellen. That's what we're trying to do. And we give them integrative tools to help them get better. But be clear, if parents don't change the kids' diet, and I can employ the best treatment modalities, they can get better briefly, but they will relapse. And that's been my experience.
Right. There's this thing where I know in my practice, you know, people will change their diet for a few days and they feel kind of better. And so then they stop the change, right? So when you're talking about making changes, what are the significant changes you could tell our listeners? Look, these are the things, just basically, if you did these, this would be a great start in improving your health, your child's health. What would be those first steps? Besides eating organic?
The first step, obviously, we already said it, eat organic. That's clear. If they can eat organic because of access, price, whatever, you know, limitations, if they can decrease the amount of processed food that they eat and cook their own food more, eat out less, and bring their food to school or work. If there are some challenges there, what I ask families to do is if they can decrease the amount of genetically modified food they eat, because I find those are significant problems, which would be, for children, soy and corn. 85% of processed products in the supermarket contain a genetically modified food. So that's why I stress, please, you know, eat, cook at home, and as much shopping around the periphery of your supermarket rather than down the center aisle. So if they can begin to make those changes, they'll see benefits, health benefits. If they could add in some fermented foods to their kids' diet, and some kids are kind of picky, and they don't often like these foods, but if they can get kids to eat fermented foods such as sauerkraut or pickles, kefir, yogurt if they're not dairy sensitive, I try to get fermented foods in their diets, and parents can ferment at home. It's really simple. You know, I can do it, and I'm no Martha Stewart. So these are the kind of things that we ask folks to do. I see if they can purchase a simple water filter. I ask them to do that as well. You know, we all know what happened in Flint, Michigan. I'm not so sure about all the water systems throughout the U.S. I don't know what the water system is like in your neck of the woods in Portland, but I think a water filter system helps get out some of the chemicals. So those are basic things they can do. And lastly, if they can decrease the amount of toxicants in the external environment, by taking off shoes at the door. Dust, house dust, is one of the most toxic things in people's environments. So if they can do simply trying to modulate the child's internal and external environment, kids will get better.
I was going to jump in here as well, because it's really, obviously it's really important for people to do what they can on an individual level. But, you know, one of the things we're trying to convey in this book is that it shouldn't just be an individual choice issue. And of course, trying to change people's diets, as you know, as a practitioner, is very hard. And most doctors know this, and that's probably why they don't deal with food very much, because it's very hard to get people to change their diet. But if we see the problem as one of a public health disaster, then we have to start looking at other kinds of interventions that operate at a higher level. For instance, in getting rid of food deserts and making sure organic is provided in places where it's not so expensive it can't be eaten by people. And then finally, just making sure that our food supply system has as minimal use of pesticides as possible, which in most cases that we talk about in the book means rethinking the paradigm of genetic modification.
Yeah, that's a big monster to fight back against, huh?
Yes. You know, I just want to mention, Ellen, quite a few of us were in Sacramento here in California this past week with our legislative people to see if we can get a bill passed here in California to hold herbicide spraying at children's schools, parks, and daycare centers. So this what Vincent is referring to is absolutely true. It starts in the home, but yes, we have to have a bigger vision here and bring it to, you know, to law. And so that it's not so difficult for people to make these changes. And if I had my druthers, I would say, why is organic food called organic? It should be conventional food, should be organic. And then we can talk about industrial food as the other.
Yeah, that's a really good point. A few years ago, I was interviewing a developmental nutritionist, Kelly Dorfman, and I asked her, I said, you know, people have been eating soy and corn and wheat for millennia, and people didn't get sick. And all of a sudden, people can't tolerate these foods anymore. I said, what's the difference? And she said, glyphosates, you know, Roundup.
And yeah, we have a whole chapter on it.
I know you do, and it's fascinating. But, you know, I think people don't really think about that, the way that wheat is harvested and its impact on health. And you also bring up in the book something that seems even more troubling, which are these BT toxins. Or could you talk about that a little?
Sure. So BT is the second most common form of genetic modification, which is the transfer of a Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a naturally occurring bacteria. It's been used for generations by farmers to get rid of insects on plants. And historically, when it was sprayed on the top, it would wash off with time. But now the genetic modification technique, they're able to put the protein that kills insects inside of the plant itself. So they've essentially turned the food into a form of pesticide. And originally, when engineers designed this, they assumed that it wouldn't be effective in the human gut because of the different pH with insect guts. But we now know that most of the BT that's inserted, BT-ready seeds and plants, have a form of BT that's pre-activated. And there have been some studies that are showing that there are impacts of that on the guts. For instance, in the insect gut, it essentially works by punching holes in the lining of the gut and then allowing the insect to die by a form of septicemia. We don't know whether that's happening in humans. We do know that there are studies that show that even BT alone has health effects. And, you know, these studies are contested, but there's a whole story behind that as well. Mm. So that is the second. And usually Roundup-ready crops, which is the most common form of genetic modified foods, come with stacked traits of BT as well.
So we really are in this kind of second silent spring, as you describe in the book.
Yes. Right. I think Rachel Carson would be turning over in her grave if she actually saw where we've kind of relapsed to. We're in a ecological relapse as far as we're concerned.
Yeah, and Rachel Carson was a scientist, an ecology writer who wrote the books Silent Spring and really brought to light the dangers of DDT spraying, which then ended.
Yes, they're looking to, DDT has been brought back in the market, Ellen, and so because as more weeds have become resistant to glyphosate, approximately 75% of them, they've had to bring in a type of DDT type of herbicide back. So we're still dealing with the same toxic chemical soup that Rachel Carson had dealt with in the 60s and the 70s. She passed away early in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would add, one of the interesting things about the history of this is that, you know, we have to recognize that these genetic modifications were in part designed so that we could move off of things like DDT. They were, at the time, perceived of as a really great solution. And unfortunately, at the time, we didn't really know that much about the microbiome. We didn't know anything about the microbiome in humans. So things like glyphosate were seen as a perfect alternative to spraying Agent Orange, for instance, which is a selective herbicide, and glyphosate is a broad-spectrum herbicide.
Right.
But what we didn't know at the time was that the argument against glyphosate being toxic is that human cells don't have the shikimate pathway, which is the enzymatic pathway that's disrupted by glyphosate. But we now know that the human body does have cells that have the shikimate pathway, and these are the things that we're concerned about with the use of glyphosate now. So there's a certain amount of, in time, we've learned that we should be more worried about these things, even though there are some who will argue that the companies knew there were risks back then. Probably they thought they were worth the risks and the profits that were in. But now we have this whole machinery around growing food that is so dependent on these products that there's, it's sort of like, feels like you can't go back. And now the evidence is coming out that there's more dangers than we ever knew.
So there are kind of two tides happening. There's this industrial pesticide-laden GMO tide, but there is another tide. And, you know, we know organics are more available. We know that people, there are more farmers markets. We know that people are indeed more aware. So can you tell us a little bit of the seeds of optimism out there that can, are there?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Let's get out of the closet of doom and gloom here. And the seeds of optimism. Thank you, Ellen. Well, yes, people are aware. People definitely want genetically modified products labeled. They're choosing non-GMO because there's a significant non-GMO labeling force out there. And organic food sales are astronomically high now. As a matter of fact, this is not a plug for Costco, but Costco is the leading purchaser of organic food in the U.S. So there is increased accessibility to organics. It's happening. The awareness factor is profound. People are getting on board. There is change afoot. When we left Sacramento just the other day, there was a buzz in the Capitol that there were so many legislators who want to get on board this legislation. So change is happening there. And in our own Marin County, a plug for Conscious Kitchen, a group of, you know, amazing people are bringing organic food to public schools with chefs. These amazing chefs, Alice Waters leading the charge behind it. So there's all kinds of good stuff happening. And not only that, like groups like, you know, who are bringing organic food to school lunch, groups at UCSF are actually studying how kids are doing when we make these changes. So we're monitoring it to see what type of effects we're seeing from these changes. And to remember to tell the for your audience that when we make these changes, people get better. Significantly, and it happens within anywhere from 3 days, the shortest I've seen, to 4 weeks. So people just have to be a bit patient.
I would add, too, that, you know, we're seeing a lot of great momentum around urban farms and people who are creating and cultivating in food wastelands. And one thing that's really important to remember about those efforts is that they have to remember not to use Roundup, because it's a surprise to learn that a lot of the Roundup that's sprayed in the U.S. is not just on large commercial farms. A lot of it is sprayed in urban environments, in family gardens and parks. And it's important that if we're doing urban renewal with gardening and local food sourcing, that people remember not to rely on Roundup. And use alternative forms.
Which there are many.
Control, right. Which there are many. Exactly.
Yes. So, Dr. Perro and Vincent Adams, how could people get in touch with you if they want to learn more about your work or if they'd like to come see you for a consult?
Certainly. So, of course, they can read the book, and we are, our publisher's Chelsea Green, and they've been fabulous. If they'd like to reach me, they can go to michelle@gmoscience.org, which is a website that I direct, and we bring health information that is science-based to readers. And presently, I'm not practicing in my own practice, but I am supervising at Gordon Medical here in Marin County, and I have been doing a lot of educating for certain companies, including BioResource and Despio and other phenomenal companies, where I've been doing a lot of educating. So I'm in the talk circuit, and of course, Vincent and I have been trying to get the word out to parents, to doctors, to educators, to listeners about, you know, what people can do at home. Do-it-yourself things that they can do at home as we begin to change the legislative land.
That's great.
Yeah, so for me, I can be reached through my university affiliation at UCSF.
Wonderful. Well, you know, this is a really fantastic book for people who are curious to really learn about the links between our environment, the foods we eat, and health, and especially for children, because children are our future. We have been speaking with Dr. Michelle Perro and Dr. Vincent Adams about their book, What's Making Our Children Sick? The Industrial Food, How Industrial Food is Causing an Epidemic of Chronic Illness and What Parents and Doctors Can Do About It. Michelle and Vincent, thank you for the wonderful work you're doing and for being with us today here on Health Watch.
Our pleasure, Ellen. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for having us. It's been great.
I am Ellen Goldsmith, licensed acupuncturist, your host. You can listen to this episode and more episodes of Health Watch online at kboo.fm/healthwatch.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film This Changes Everything on Thursday, January 11th at 7 p.m. Filmed over 211 shoot days in 9 countries and 5 continents over 4 years, This Changes Everything is an attempt to reimagine the vast challenge of climate change. The film is narrated by Naomi Klein and presents 7 portraits of communities on the front lines, from Montana to South India to Beijing and beyond. Again, that's a film screening of This Changes Everything, Thursday, January 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 8th here in Portland, and today we're talking about the case of Ahed Tamimi, 16-year-old Palestinian who is imprisoned right now by the State of Israel. This Saturday, January 13th, here in Portland, at noon, there will be a vigil at Pioneer Courthouse Square, followed at 12:30 by a march. It is a women's march for Palestine, specifically focusing on the case of Ahed Tamimi and of all Palestinian children imprisoned. The vigil and march will also focus on Trump's declaration that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, demand an end to the siege on Gaza, demand an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and demand freedom, justice, and equality, and human rights for all Palestinians. I am speaking now with Jesse Locke, who is a filmmaker from here in Bend, Oregon, and recently made the film